heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 133, covering the week of August 6th through August 10th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. We also exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you go to abbevilleinstitute.org, at the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support. You'll have donor options. You can donate monthly or annually. All our choices are there. So please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. Help keep the podcast going, the website going, our conferences going. Speaking of conferences, we do have a conference coming up November 9th through 10th in Texas. Details are going to be released on the website within the next couple of weeks, so be on the lookout for that. But make plans. It's going to be on nullification and secession. It's going to be a great time. So you're going to want to be in Texas in the first week of November. And, of course, you can get the Abbeville Institute on the go. Just go out to your favorite web application store. Download the app. Just look for Abbeville Institute, and you can get this podcast, all of our lectures, and, of course, mobile access to our website. So get the app. It's free, painless. Just put it on your phone and get all that great stuff. Okay. And by the way, subscribe to the podcast as well. If you go out to iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast. And when you do so, leave a review of the podcast. It helps boost it up the ratings. It helps, boost it up where people can see the podcast. So leave a review, hopefully a 5-star review, so more and more people can see the podcast. And since you enjoy it, more people will enjoy it. All right. Well, let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. We published a lot of stuff this week about historical accuracy. And the first two pieces of the week really work well together in that way. In fact, it shows that the meaning of the South, the Southern tradition, what the South is under assault from both sides. What do I mean by both sides? Well, certainly we expect those on the left to generally dislike the Southern tradition for a variety of reasons. And it's funny because there are things about the Southern tradition that they do seem to like. For example, there are many environmentalists who go out and read I'll Take My Stand. These neo-hippies who go out and read I'll Take My Stand, and they like parts of that book. There are Marxists who are going out and reading Sociology for the South, which is... some people would say is a communist manifesto for the South written in the antebellum period. So there are things that the critique of capitalism. I mean, Southerners were critiquing capitalism in the antebellum period, industrial capitalism. They were advancing an agrarian narrative, but they're not Marxists. Southerners were not Marxists. In fact, they were very much against it. They looked at it as a scheming reform movement. I mean, Dabney was quite clear about this, and so were many others. But the thing is, there are parts of the Southern tradition that the left seems to admire. But then, overall, they don't like its traditionalism. They don't like its Christianity. They don't like the parts of the South that, frankly, looking in the 21st century, would be considered to be part of the Southern tradition that we don't advance, which is the racial element of it. So there are things they don't like about the South, and they do believe that Southerners overall lied about their history and their tradition after the war was over. So you have that. I mean, that's the main part of this. They lied. Southerners lied. Why did they fight the war? Well, they lied about it after the war was over. Because they didn't bring up slavery at all. They said it didn't have anything to do with slavery. And that's a lie. And because of that, we had a quote-unquote white supremacist view of the South, and that would influence the North, and all these people would be duped by Southerners, and the whole process of remembering the war was a great big lie. So you have that position. And then you have those on the right, which actually they agree with that, and they're much more dangerous because their narrative is not just that Southerners lied, but they really promote the Republican Party, and they push this righteous cause mythology because it's political to them. You see, if the Republican Party can be painted as the party of civil rights, as the party of Lincoln, and the Democrats can be everything bad, well, that applies to 2018. You see, so it's all about politics. And each side believes in this righteous cause mythology. They all believe in it. So the South is getting squeezed from two sides. And the neoconservatives are much more dangerous because you expect these things out of the left. But it's when you would look to allies on, say, the right, conservatives, people that call themselves conservatives. And I remember I was reading an essay by Richard Weaver the other day, and one of his political essays. And he said this. He wrote that there are people running around. Of course, Weaver died in the 1960s, but he said the people are running around calling themselves conservatives who really aren't in the 1960s. And that was problematic because the people that call themselves conservatives now, if you support the Republican agenda of the Reconstruction period and the way they were recreating America, it's not really conservative. It's not conservative at all. I mean, when you look at economics, it was a much more industrial capitalist society, which was not conservative. That was something that was completely different and alien. In fact, the Deep North and the Northern economy was the oddball in the 19th century. The South, being the agrarian section, is very much like everywhere else in the world except for Germany and Great Britain. And we can look back and say, well, by industrializing the South, the United States, and of course the South ultimately part of that too, became this world power. And if it wasn't for that, maybe the South is still living in the third world. So, I mean, this is looking at history in reverse. We don't know that. We don't know what would have happened. We don't know what would have happened if the South was not destroyed economically by the war. What would have happened there? I mean, the South was a very wealthy section. And that's just one example. You look at politically, some of the things, the leveling tendencies of the North. I mean, all these things were going on. So the North was certainly not the quote-unquote conservative section in the period following the war. But yet, this is what modern Republicans try to portray. They try to portray Lincoln as conservative. And if you compare him to the radical Republicans, certainly he was. I mean, Lincoln was a reconciliationist, without question. And his version of what should happen when the war was over was much different than, say, Thad Stevens' version of what should happen when the war was over. So in that way, I mean, when you compare and contrast, yes, Lincoln was a conservative, but overall he was not. So you've got these great tugs, and I'll talk about, you know, an example of each in these first two pieces, but I actually want to start with the piece on Friday, and it's by Walt Garlington. It's entitled The Southern Saga, and I want to talk about one part of the piece, and one of the reasons why we published this is because of something that he said here that I think is very important. He says, quote, "What Southerners do not realize is that they are part of a much more real and much more meaningful drama than they are aware of. Burning memories and experiences like those of Mladen," who's an author that he cited at the beginning, "are just beneath the surface of every Southerner's life. How and why? Because the war for the South never ended. Yes, the bullets stopped flying long ago, but the effort to eradicate the traditional Southern way of life has continued. Again, from both sides." And that's not his, that's my, I'm adding that. "In light of this, everything takes on new significance. Every word and action becomes part of an extended and very subtle battlefield. How we choose to speak or to conduct business, where we choose to live, the way we spend our free time, what we teach our children, the food we eat, the books we read, whether we write a thank you note, everything great and small is an opportunity either for the strengthening of Southern culture or for its further decay. This is the heavy burden of any real folk, the struggle to retain what was handed down to us by our fathers and mothers, sometimes in the face of seemingly overwhelming circumstances. Nevertheless, we must fight. If we do not, we are guilty of desecrating the memory and achievements of our forebears. We are guilty of condemning Southern children to a rootless existence in the virtual world of Twitter and Snapchat. We are guilty of turning our neighbors, black and white, from fellow Southern kinsmen into ridiculous political caricatures, Republicans, Democrats, etc., that we heap hatred upon. We are guilty of turning our villages and towns into the chamber pots of parasitic multinational corporations. This war may seem unreal, but the scars of its battles are all very real. Shuttered churches, rotting barns, insolent youth, disintegrating families and neighborhoods. No Southerner has to look to a movie screen to give his life significance. He is already in the middle of a grave conflict. Every moment is pregnant with meaning. I like that part of this piece. And then he goes on. Few things are of greater weight than the fate of an entire country. No one was or is unimportant in this fight, not the private in the Confederate Army of yesterday, neither the poor farmer nor the blue-collar mechanic of today. Every moment, skirmishes are being fought all across Dixie by high-born and low-born alike, and the hundreds of decisions all are making. The great struggle in all of them is to live deliberately as Southerners. If we are mindful of this and struggle manfully, the South may yet see good days. If you are not mindful of this and live carefree, the dominant, vicious, materialistic culture manufactured in the bowels of a corporate marketing department will eradicate what is left of Southern folkways. So there are a couple of things here that I really liked in this. Number one, he brings up memory. Memory, how we remember things. This is what we do at the Institute, how we remember things. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition? What do we take from that tradition? Because all traditions, as I said on this podcast over and over again, have good and bad. What do we take from the Southern tradition that is good? One of the things that he brings up is this consumer culture grinds down tradition. What we have in America today, throughout America, North or South, is very much a cultureless people. We have a middle-class, quote-unquote, culture, which is just a consumer culture. It really means nothing. There is no tide anywhere. There's no estate. There's no meaning in the land. There's no meaning in place. Now, Southerners hang on to this longer than other people. And certainly people have pride in maybe their football team, of their college, or even their city. You know, if you look at the NFL, when the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl last year, I mean, people had pride in that in Philadelphia, where the Eagles win. And certainly there is a culture to people in Philadelphia. If you go there, you see it. And they have pride in that. People have pride in being from New York or Boston. People have pride in being from a Southern state. No one in the South ever says, I have pride in being from Atlanta. They're being from Georgia, right? It's bigger. But in the North, it's more tied into a city. People have pride in being from Chicago or from Los Angeles. They have pride in these things, and certainly these areas have a culture to them. But for the most part, American culture is very plastic. It is. It's what kind of things can we buy? What kind of devices can we have? What kind of social media networks can we get on? Whatever the case may be, it's very plastic. It's an identity in nothing. Whereas the South has meaning to it, and all of these little things that he brings up, simple things of respect. This is one thing that consumer culture wears down. It's how we treat each other. You know, manners are a way of showing other people respect. And so when you lose your manners, you lose your respect for other people, whether it's writing a thank you note, as he brings up, or the way you interact with people, the way you show people respect. That was one thing the South is always well known for. It's sunny people, the sunny disposition, Southern hospitality. There are parts of the South now where that doesn't even exist because they're not really the South anymore. You can't take, and there's a piece we're going to run next week by yours truly where I say this, and you can take the Yankee out of the North, but you can't take the Yankee out of the man. I mean, it doesn't matter where they go. They want to come to the South because they think if they come to the South, their life is going to change significantly, but yet they're still Yankees. It's still in them. You can't get rid of that. It's their culture. So you have this want for many Southerners to rekindle the good things about Southern culture, but you have to do it deliberately, as he says. And the memory of the South is important. The memory of the South, how we choose to remember the South, and you cannot let other people tell you what that memory should be, meaning outside forces. And so that's where we get to the piece, the book review on Tuesday, which is on that very topic. It's a book review of David Blight's Race and Reunion, which is a book that is a pioneer in what's called memory studies. And this book is cited all over the place. All over the place. Anytime you bring up the idea that you have a version of the war that's given the lost cause pejorative, Blight's book is right there to say, here it is. This is the definitive study to show that you Southerners are wrong. Because look, this is the real memory of the war. You are just making everything up. You're lying, is the point. But this book has got all kinds of problems with it. I remember I was in a social media debate with a Princeton professor, and I might have mentioned this on this podcast. I know I talked about it on my own. A Princeton professor, and I said, show me one example where you can find that a Confederate monument was erected. I mean, you can find it in the documents. It was erected for the simple purpose of white supremacy. And what he did is copied an Amazon link to Race and Reunion. And this book proves nothing. And I said, well, show me. So, of course, people will bring up speeches where somebody goes up at a dedication ceremony and they'll say something racist. One that's going around the internet now was there's a monument in Florence, Alabama, which at the dedication ceremony, one of the speakers brought up Booker T. Washington's dinner with Theodore Roosevelt in 1901. And this monument was put up a couple of years later, and he brought it up and talked about it there at the dedication ceremony. Of course, used racist language in doing it. And there's the example. They say, well, here it is. This monument's for white supremacy. That doesn't mean anything. It just means the man that made the talk, which he also, of course, talked about why the monument was there for the Confederate soldier. All it means is that the person giving the speech held those views. And you can surmise that probably most of the audience held similar views, but so did most of America in 1903. Just go back and look at the way that particular dinner was received, North and South, you'll find that the majority of Americans held the same exact views. So this is nothing unique. You could make the same case as these monuments went up in northern cities, that people held the same views there. It was about the Union soldiers, but yet they probably still held similar views. So it means nothing. And yet, to Blight, it means everything. And so what the reviewer does is talk about the fact that this book shouldn't be subtitled The Civil War in American Memory. It should be subtitled The Civil War in African American Memory. And there's nothing wrong with that. I've actually said when I reviewed this book on my own podcast, that part of the book is very valuable. How did the African American community remember the war? It's a great part of the book. Fantastic. It enriches our understanding of American history. How did this group of people remember the war? It's a vital part of studying American history. But at the same time, this is not a book that really accurately defines how other people remember the war. And Blight is a professor of history at Yale University, so he has a lot of pull. This is a guy that has free lectures online. You go out and watch, and of course, his lectures are awful. I don't think anybody, if you've watched these things, could stay awake for more than about 5 minutes watching them. They're terrible. But of course, because he's at Yale, he's a distinguished professor of history at Yale, this matters. One of the things he brings up is the first Decoration Day, and he says it took place on May 1st, 1866 in Charleston, South Carolina, but no one ever cited this thing as the definitive first Memorial Day. In fact, it ignores all the history around it, whether it was in the South or whether it was in the North. It was never, this event was a one-off, and it never was the first Decoration Day. But this is the, as the reviewer says, this is the emancipationist view or experience of the war. Or only experience, quote, to the detriment of a fuller understanding of the process of memorialization. And he focuses entirely in the book on race, and this is what you have. It ignores all the other parts of race. And I remember when I was in a graduate seminar, South Carolina, and again, I might have said this here too, there was a look at Reconstruction. As we've gotten along in historical studies, the way we look at Reconstruction is narrowed. When you look at Dunning, the Dunning School, it was a very broad view of Reconstruction. It was political, it was economic, it was social. And so Reconstruction studies focus on all these things. Now we just focus on one thing, which is race. Nothing else matters in Reconstruction. You see, it doesn't matter about the economic part of Reconstruction, because that blows apart their narrative. It doesn't matter on the political part of Reconstruction, North and South, because that blows apart their narrative. You can't say the United States is being recreated in every way, because all they want to do is focus on race because that suits their agenda. So this is the point, this memory studies, how we remember the war, is important. How this war is portrayed is important. One of the books that the reviewer brings up is this Jim Downs book about the effects of Reconstruction on the black population, where he contends that 1 million blacks in the South were struck with illness because of the conditions Northern armies created, and that many thousands of them died. This is not a Southern historian. This is a mainstream book, but he brings up the fact that the policies of the Union Army were dangerous for black Americans in the South. One of the things that the reviewer brings up too, he says, quote, while Blight makes an interesting argument that the triumph of the reconciliationist vision was intentionally pursued by whites in both sections, he often makes this seem an unnatural, even nefarious betrayal of the true vision, quote, the emancipationist vision. In doing so, Blight ignores that for the majority of Northern whites, reconciliation was not only seen as the natural and needed course, but one that grew out of its prioritization and the Union's very war aims. While emancipation became a part of the war effort as a military strategy, and by 1863, those who championed the right of black slaves were always a minority within the Union government, military leadership, and rank and file. For most of these men, the cause remained the preservation of the Union from the beginning of the war until its end. It should come as no surprise, then, that after the war, with the Union preserved by Northern standards, that most of these men who fought for that purpose first or that purpose alone would seek to see all parts of that Union reconciled without reference to black political rights. This is entirely true. You see, reconciliation was there before the war, it was there after the war, and there were different manifestations of this. But Lincoln only got 39% of the popular vote. I mean, the majority view was always reconciliationist. It was always, let's come up with a way to solve this problem without going to war. And that didn't win out because Lincoln was at the helm. And so let's talk about Lincoln. The piece on Monday, The Death of Historical Accuracy, gets into this new movie by Dinesh D'Souza, which is The Death of a Nation, and Boyd Cathy wrote this, and talks about all the historical problems with the film, that, I mean, it's historically inaccurate. As Boyd says, D'Souza's narrative is essentially a leftist one, and like other neoconservatives, he partakes of the basic philosophical view of the post-communist left, emphasizing politicized constructs of race and gender, inequality and democracy, projecting them back into to incorporate all of American history. Thus, so it goes, echoing Marxist historians like Eric Foner, quote, the South had slavery, therefore it was a racist society. Racism had to be opposed at all costs and by all means, and that is what Lincoln did. The equation says too much and leaves out too much. And so this is just a simplistic narrative, but he's doing it to project the Republican Party as the party today as the same party in 1860. Now, I would actually agree with that in some ways. In some ways, he's correct about this. The Republican Party really has never changed. It's always been a nationalist party. It's always been interested in a nationalist agenda, their own nationalist agenda. That's never changed. It's never really embraced states' rights or federalism. And that way, the Republican Party is exactly the same. It's always been the stupid party. But Lincoln, as a man who is this, I mean, it's a leftist view of Abraham Lincoln. It's wrong. As he brings up Lincoln's views on race, on slavery, and other things. So there's a lot to get into here. And as he brings up William Marvel, whose Mr. Lincoln Goes to War is a wonderful book, William Marvel said this, quote, it was Lincoln, however, who finally issued diplomacy and sparked a confrontation. He backed himself into a corner from which he could escape only by mobilizing a national army and thereby fanning the flames of Fort Sumter into a full-scale conflagration. It's just silly, this particular movie and the book that goes along with it. You can get it anywhere now. I mean, it's a major bestseller. The movie has been seen by all kinds of people. And unfortunately, conservatives, quote-unquote conservatives, are going to go out and watch this and think the South is awful. That's what's going to happen. The Fox News series Legends and Lies did the exact same thing. This is the push now. The Republican Party are the good guys. The Democrats are the bad guys, no matter when they are. The modern Democrats are the same thing. You have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and plantation garb. These are two Yankees, two Northerners. And the Democrats have always been the bad guys. The Republicans have always been the good guys. This is a simplistic and, frankly, stupid version of American history. But that's what you get when you watch Dinesh D'Souza. It's what you get when you read David Blight. You see, you're getting it from both ends. It's coming out of both ends. We know that's a bad thing. Coming out of both ends is not a good thing. And then you get to Phil Lee's piece on Thursday, Causes of the Civil War, where we've run pieces by Philip Lee before. His book, Southern Reconstruction, is fantastic. He's got a book out through Shotwell Press on Southern gangsters, which is a fun little topic, in Arkansas. Go out and get that, too. And that's not expensive. It's but go out and buy that book. I mean, this is something that we need more New South stuff. So we got Southern gangsters in Arkansas and Hot Springs. You wonder where Bill Clinton comes from. Well, it's there you go. I mean, there's a correlation between organized crime in Arkansas there and the Clinton regime later on, which is interesting. But he brings up the fact that regardless of what Southern states said when they seceded from the Union, the war itself was not caused by slavery. The war itself was caused by a desire to save the Union. And why did the North want to save the Union? Because of tariff revenue. Either the lack of revenue or to get revenue. It's one or the other. But, I mean, the economics part of this war was very important. Northern newspapers were pointing it out. The war itself was only brought about because the North decided to go fight the South to stay in the Union. That's what brought about the war. So you could say, well, if there was no secession, there'd be no war. Well, the North could have chosen not to, and many Northerners are saying, don't go fight. That was a conscious choice. There didn't have to be a war when secession took place. It didn't have to happen that way, but it did because the North made a decision to do that. And why did they make a decision to do that? They didn't make a decision to do that to go free slaves. They made a decision to do it to go and make sure that their economic model would stay in place. So it's a quick little piece, one that's worth your time to go read and go out and get Philip Lee's books. And then on Wednesday, we're running up against time here. On Wednesday, we ran a couple of poems by Donald Davis, and Wednesday, August 8th, was his birthday. And so these are great poems, Southward Returning and Sanctuary, and they are pregnant with meaning, and they fit nicely into Walt Garlington's piece on Friday, and what the South actually means, and why it was important, and what it means to defend it. Southward Returning is about Southerners coming home from the war. Sanctuary has got a lot of meaning to it. It's a poem of the guerrilla campaign, or at least the idea of what to do should the Yankees come in these final stages of the war. But it's also more than that. It's about tradition. It's about what's happening to the South and the carnage that the war brought to the South. And so it's one of these poems that you read it and you read it again and you read it again and you'll get something new out of it every time. Walt Garlington was bringing up what's happened in the South, and so is Donald Davidson and Sanctuary. And it's important to understand the carnage that's been left by this classic consumer culture. And it's what we're doing here at the Abbeville Institute to try to get people to realize there's still a lot in the South that's valuable. There are still things you need to consciously live. You need to live with purpose. Don't just drift in life, but live with purpose. And if you do that, you'll make a difference. Think small. Don't worry about changing the world. Think in your own household and with your own friends and family, in your own community. If you do that, things will change. Until next time, good day.